Arizona is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Solis to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Criminal defense attorney Mike Gillespie will be joining us here in the studio tonight. Huntsville reporter outside of the death house, Joseph Clark, and special guest Mike Ware, executive director and co-founder of the Innocence Project of Texas. The execution watch for Mark Solis begins.
People of Texas, children of God. It's insane. In Jesus' name. Where's all that religious compassion?
Good evening and welcome to the Tuesday, September 10th, 2019 edition of Execution Watch. Whether you're listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. If you are tuning in for Nuestras Palabras, usually heard here every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m., you can hear them on the HD2 channel. Just check the kpft.org website for the link. And please, check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. And of course, you can always join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute 37-year-old Mark Anthony Solis, sentenced to death for the June 29, 2010 shooting death of Nancy Hatch Weatherly, 61, in her home near Godley, Texas. According to the AP, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, state and federal appeals courts have all turned down numerous requests for Solis' attorney, Seth Kreitzer, to stop tonight's execution. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil providing first-hand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. To you on death row, we say, there is always hope. Joining us tonight in the studio to put this case in perspective is going to be Mike Gillespie. He'll be joining me in just a few moments. But first, our reporter Joseph Clark joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Joseph.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for doing this for us. We know that Mark Solis has been transported to the death house and is now lying on a gurney with a needle in his arm, waiting for the drugs to be dispersed and to take his final breath. There'll be no religious figure. There was no final meal. If you don't mind, describe the scene outside the walls for us.
Right now we have about 18 protesters. His family is out here. He has a bunch of cousins out here. And we got Gloria on the megaphone, and his family actually got on the megaphone as well. The witnesses have already crossed the road, which means the procedure is about to take place. He has a spiritual advisor in there with him in the witness room, and also his brother. There is people there with him. His family said they spoke to him today and that he's at peace with what's going to happen, and he's accepted the Lord into his life, so he knows where he's going after this.
So 18 people, that's really kind of a big crowd for the people who stand out there if it's not a police involved incident. Or what yes. kind of signs are you seeing?
Well, right now we have a bunch of signs asking people to honk if they if they're against the death penalty. We got a couple of honks already. We have a bunch of different signs just explaining why they are against the death penalty. And so it's a very sad scene out here. But yes, it is a big crowd than normally, which is good.
More interest going on now. Well, Joseph, will you please contact us when you hear something?
Yes, ma'am, I will.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Joseph Clark. He's standing in front of the Death House in Huntsville, Texas. Now, Mark Anthony Solis, known as Kilo, as a confirmed member of the Puro Tango Blast Gang, was no stranger to being on the wrong side of the law. With multiple prior prison records for theft, the man with an eighth-grade education went on a multi-day, two-county crime spree, along with co-defendant Jose Clermont Ramos, leading to the death of Nancy Weatherly in her rural home. And it wasn't even the first shooting of the day for Solis. So joining me now in the studio is Mike Gillespie. Mike, let me tell us about what happened during that week in 2010.
Well, it all started not that week, but a couple weeks before when Mr. Solis was released from prison. He had a fairly extensive prison record, not much, but a couple. He just got out of prison. He hooked up with his partner, who was a friend of his sister's, and they set out on a crime spree. The crime spree started with the burglary of a house to get some guns.
And this was his main thing. He was really a burglar. Is this correct?
I didn't pick that up. I saw he was basically a car thief. Whether he was a thief and didn't get caught on those things, but what he went to prison for was auto theft. Mm-hmm. So he was a thief, but I did not know if he was a burglar. What I do know is that they broke into the house, they stole the guns. Once they stole the guns, they then went out and went on to a crime spree that is pretty legendary.
Let me verify again, too, that when you say they, you're talking about Jose Ramos?
Jose Ramos was his partner.
Okay.
They committed ...13 different offenses by Solis alone, and others with Ramos. So he committed 13 offenses, not to mention what he did with his co-defendant Ramos. Including with those is 2 days after stealing the gun, they approached a man in a mall and attempted to rob him. Later the same day, they involved themselves in an argument between two men, and Solis asked one man, "Do you want the other man wet?" meaning bloody. Then he shot him in the ear. Later that day, they carjacked a man's pickup truck. Later that day, they approached a man in a convenience store, stole his wallet and gun at gunpoint. Several days later, they approached two men and a woman in a parking lot, pistol-whipped a man and stole his wallet. The next day, they shot multiple bullets into a Fort Worth house in retaliation on a gang argument. Later the same day, they robbed a Fort Worth man as he walked out of his car, shooting him multiple times in his chest and stomach. Still later that day, they approached a Lowe's home improvement store in the parking lot and robbed a guy in the parking lot and shot multiple shots at the man as he ran away. Then they went to a convenience store, and there was a beer delivery driver named Martinez. They shot and killed him as they robbed him. Martinez was shot in the spine. His spine was pulverized. He was paralyzed and in pain, and his wife testified that she couldn't do anything to alleviate his pain before he died, and he died in tremendous pain. After that, they then leave, and they go to Johnson County, the scene of this crime.
A neighboring county.
Yeah. Now, all the things we talked about are not relevant to this case. That's just the history before this case. They become relevant to his future dangerousness, but the case is about this one case on Ms. Weatherly. According to reports, they knocked on the door of somebody they did not know. Ms. Weatherly, who was in her 60s, who had a t-shirt on saying Granny. She opened the door, they put a gun in her face, and they robbed her. There's some dispute as to who robbed her. Mr. Ramos testified that he laid the gun on the table and went outside. Solis, in his first statement, said he didn't shoot the lady, and then somehow on his confession is added, I shot the lady. I don't know how a confession is made formal, and then there's an added to it, I shot the lady. In the confession, he said he didn't shoot the lady, but on the handwritten amendment, he did. In any event, the thing about this case, and this is a jury that took 10 minutes to find him guilty, incredibly quick on a capital murder trial. But what really hurt him was one of his girlfriends, and it seemed like they were doing meth together. She came in and testified that he told her that he was robbing the lady. He went to take the lady's jewelry box, and the lady said, no, that box belonged to my deceased mother. And Mr. Solis says, then go be with her, and shot her in the back of the head. Then she talked about, in trial, about how Mr. Solis talked about how much the woman begged for her life and begged for mercy before he killed her, and then he killed her. I'm sure that evidence itself was the primary evidence to make this a capital murder case. My problem with all this is, who is this girl, and why is she coming to court talking? The law is really clear. You can't come to court to talk unless you have proof it's true. I can't come in and say you did something. I can't come in and say you and me robbed the store, unless I can say before robbing the store, we went to Home Depot and bought some mask and gloves and tape. If they find proof that we bought the mask and gun and tape together, then that gives credibility to what I'm saying. But I didn't see anything here about credibility. She came to court and she said these things. You know, one of the troubles in these capital cases, and just like in this, the next problem with this case is, why did the other co-defendant get a plea bargain?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, basically speaking, why did they choose to only prosecute Solis for the Johnson County murder and not Ramos?
I was really puzzled by that because they did everything together. And under the law of parties rule, they're both guilty of it. Texas is real strong on parties. And we've had cases in this show that we were stunned by somebody being executed who did nothing besides be there. These are two people who did everything together. Why was one given life in prison with no parole and the other given the death penalty? I was puzzled by that. But in looking at it, it seems like his behavior was so out of control in the time he was in jail that they wanted him to be the one to take the fall. And what we're talking about, at the trial, they had videos of him in the holdover cell. They had videos of him in the jail. And they showed all these videos to the jury about how violent he is. Well, the problem with that, it's like when I step on your foot and they film you hitting me, you look violent, but they don't show that I started the fight by stepping on your foot. They have videos of him being violent in jail. But in the content of this crime, that's not really relevant to this crime. And we don't know how out of contact it was. So what they have is a man that they decided that he was the one that they wanted to execute, and they made a case against him. Now, I'm not talking about whether or not this case deserved a capital punishment case. That's not my issue. My issue is, at what point do you stretch the law to make a case when it's marginal? From what I see, in fact, what's interesting is the police didn't even know about the Weatherly case because it was another county. They only found out about it because he mentioned something by going there. Then they went to the house and found her body. The officer said he would never link the two cases together. So therefore, if the Weatherly case wasn't brought up by the defendant himself, we wouldn't be here today, and he'd be doing life in prison. He's here today because he gave the information to go for the police to find Weatherly, and then his co-defendant and his girlfriend put the nails in his coffin by testifying in court about him, and that's all improper. You can't go to court and get somebody in trouble based on your words alone. You need proof. You can't just talk about it, and I've not seen anything they have to corroborate what these people said.
Again, you are listening to KPFT's Execution Watch. This is a special show that we have every time the state of Texas executes a condemned prisoner. And tonight we are here standing in vigil for Mark Anthony Solis. I'm in the studio right now with Mike Gillespie, and we're going to get back to our conversation in just a moment. If you are here looking to hear Nuestra Palabras, please check the kpft.org website. You can listen on HD2. They will be back next week. So what was Solis's defense for this? It seems like they got lucky that he was talking more than... what happened?
His basic defense, what they were trying to say was fetal alcohol syndrome. Well, fetal alcohol syndrome doesn't really work. He was blaming his mother. Maybe his lawyers are blaming his mother because his mother was supposedly a prostitute and drank, and she was drinking while he was being born. And so, therefore, he had a disadvantage in life. He had mental incapacities. He only had an eighth grade diploma. He only had an eighth grade degree. He wasn't supposedly that smart. But again, as I've said before, you know, eighth grade diplomas doesn't sound very impressive. But I know lawyers, licensed lawyers, who never went to law school and never went to college and never went to high school, but they got eighth grade diplomas. You can be pretty smart with an eighth grade diploma, especially in this job.
Well, of course, now the state of Texas hasn't really ruled on people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
That's correct. That's correct.
I mean, they're still not exempt from being from capital punishment.
That's correct.
No kind of ruling has come down. Why hasn't Solis presented an expert opinion arguing that he's intellectually disabled?
More interesting, I want to know why he started writing romantic letters to members of the jury. I think that is pretty scary. And I think that evidence coming in is horrible. When the sheriff says that he's the most dangerous man he ever had in jail, this is everybody loading up on this guy. Now, I'm not talking about whether or not this should be a capital case or not. We're not talking about that. He was on a crime spree that a lot of people injured, a lot of people were hurt. Let that be. What I don't understand is the decision to execute somebody is supposed to come from the jury. When the state has got the right to keep you in a cell, keep you hungry and lonely, and then videotape when you explode, and then come to court and say he's the most dangerous person we've ever had in this jail, and here he is writing letters to the jurors, the DA is putting evidence on to show how dangerous he is. That's not what this is about. It's not their decision to make. It is the jury's decision to make. I think the facts of this case, by themselves, the jury might have gave him the capital in spite of all that. The problem is, what we really don't know is how much evidence they really had on him and how much they got from his co-defendant. We do know the co-defendant copped a plea. The co-defendant testified against him. And the co-defendant then got life in prison with no parole. What I find interesting about this, I've never seen this before, but the co-defendant, when he took his plea for life without parole, gave up all appellate rights. I've never heard of that.
Why would someone ever do that?
I don't understand. To avoid the death penalty. If I have a choice of the death penalty or getting life in prison, no parole, I might take it, even if I'm innocent. I don't know if he's innocent. I don't know if he's guilty. But what I do know, you shouldn't pick one person who's a defendant and make him the one who's not going to be executed and use him to execute the other one. Because now the DA is deciding who lives and who dies. If all go to trial and all the facts come out and the jury decides something, it's one thing. But the DA has no business picking and choosing who they're going to prosecute. And that's what they did in this case. They picked and chose who they're going to prosecute.
Again, you are listening to Execution Watch. We're sitting here waiting for Joseph Clark to call us from Huntsville to see if the execution has proceeded. My name is Marlo Blue, and I'm sitting in the studio with Mike Gillespie. Mike, you know, This was a known gang member. He was, Solis was a member of the Puro Tango Blast, and a Hispanic gang known throughout the Texas penitentiary system. Was being a member of the Puro Tango Blast significant in any way?
They made it significant. From my own personal experience, I'm tired of the police seeing young kids in matching colored basketball uniforms, calling them a gang because they got matching colors in the right age. Gangs are easy. In fact, gangs are easy to call people, and it's such a slander to people, it just punishes them. There was problems with this in terms of gang members, they say, trying to get in the courthouse. They say they had to have extra security to keep gang members out, but there's no proof of it. But did the jurors see extra security? Did the jurors see that everybody is afraid? Yeah. It doesn't mean anything happened. I don't know. I do know that they painted a picture of a man who's dangerous, who might have been dangerous. But they both might have been dangerous. And my point is, the state is not to decide who's to live and die. Their job is to lay the facts out for the jury to decide who lives and dies. And they shouldn't be cutting deals with one for the other one to die.
If you're a gang member, can you actually get a jury of your peers?
Well, I mean, you can argue that every soldier is a gang member. I mean, I don't understand how a gang member is considered to be so bad. They use the word gang, but all a gang is a group of young males, and young men like to be together and compete with each other.
And indeed they do.
And that's got nothing to do, this was not a gang-related situation, this was not retaliation because of a gang grudge. Whether he was in a gang or not is totally irrelevant. Let me also say, a lot of people say they're in a gang for protection when they're not in a gang. It's easy to go to the world saying, I'm a gang member, because you say you're a gang member. That doesn't mean you are. The gangs sometimes have a different definition of a gang member than people do. What I found interesting is during trial, he actually scratched his gang name into the jury table of the courtroom. So forever, he will be remembered in that courthouse for what he did.
How did he even paperclip. Kill long fingernails?
Paperclip.
Right.
And again, it's surprising how he got a paperclip, but what they can't figure out is how he got the juror's address. Mm-hmm. They intercepted a romantic letter he sent to her during the trial, and they can't figure out how he got that address.
I'd like to bring in our special guest tonight, Mr. Mike Ware. Mike, of course, is the Innocence Project of Texas, was founded in 2006 by two criminal defense attorneys. That would be Jeff Blackburn of Amarillo and Mike Ware of Fort Worth. Of course, we're talking about something right now that happened in the Fort Worth area. It's the Texas Innocence Project is a nonprofit human service organization that provides legal and investigation assistance to low-income Texas citizens who have been convicted of crimes that they did not commit. Executive Director Mike Ware directs the investigative and legal services for the Innocence Project of Texas. He's an adjunct professor at Texas A&M University School of Law and supervises the Texas A&M Innocence Project Legal Clinic, which is an Innocence Texas partner. In 1984, Mike began private practice where he specializes in criminal defense. His practice included representing police officers in criminal, civil, and administrative matters, as well as investigating and litigating whistleblower claims. From July 2007 until July 2011, Mike was the Special Fields Bureau Chief for the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, which included the Conviction Integrity Unit. And in 2014, he received the Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers Association Percy Foreman Criminal Defense Lawyer of the Year Award. I'd like to welcome now Mike Ware. Mike.
Well, thank you for having me, Marlo.
Thank you for being with us. First, tell us, why an Innocence Project of Texas? What motivated you and Jeff Blackburn to create this organization?
A number of things. I mean, over the years, pr- practicing criminal defense. I know I had a number of clients that that I believed were factually innocent, and I knew that because of the culture of the time. That was really, you know, when I first started practicing. That was before post-conviction DNA testing, and certainly before post-conviction DNA testing really started to take off. And it was frustrating to go to a district attorney or an assistant district attorney or a judge and say, look, you know, this is an individual who really didn't do it, and here's why I can show that he or she really didn't do it, and to not be taken seriously because, you know, everybody knew that anybody who was charged by the police or charged by the district attorney's office, everybody knew, I use air quotes, that that person was guilty. And so anybody who you know, even made the case that someone in that situation was factually innocent was not taken seriously. And, you know, once the DNA exoneration started happening in the 90s and then in the early aughts, and people started rethinking that whole thing, then the prospect and the idea of starting an innocence project just seemed very compelling.
You know, we were just sitting here talking, Mike Gillespie and I, about how in this particular case, it's we're talking about Sulcy tonight. It seemed like the DA made a decision about what was going to go down on this. How do you choose to help? How do you choose who to help, and how do you decide that they're innocent?
Well, a whole lot of time goes into that. I mean, as opposed to, you know, a decision a district attorney makes on whether to seek the death penalty against a particular defendant, all he or she needs to do is just decide that's what they're going to do. I mean, that is completely within their absolute unfettered discretion, and so all of that decision is essentially in the hands of one person, the elected district attorney of that county. Determining, you know, that someone is actually innocent, you know, perhaps years after they have been convicted, is a lengthy and tedious and time-consuming process. I can't say that there is a formula for determining. I can say there are red flags and hallmarks of cases in which it looks like someone may have been convicted who is innocent. And, you know, you look for those, you know, among the hundreds of letters a week we get. You look for those, and then you form hypotheses, kind of like in science, you form hypotheses and then test them. Through independent means, testing or talking to witnesses or otherwise, and then you just progress on down, and you know, most cases don't make there's a very small percentage of cases where we actually file litigation, but in those cases we are absolutely certain that person is innocent.
Well, what percentage of people in prison are innocent, and particularly on Texas's death row?
Well, you know, those are two very different questions in a way. Let's just talk about in prisons in general. The honest answer is nobody knows. There are efforts to determine, you know, approximately what the percent, what the error rate is, and it involves, you know, taking the number of known, say in Texas, the number of known exonerations, and you know, figuring what percentage of total felony convictions they represent, and the percentage is fairly small. But then you take into account the fact that only a very small, I mean, it makes common sense that only a very small percentage of actually innocent individuals are ever exonerated, And you have to figure that the percentage of wrongly convicted individuals is actually much higher. The real efforts, data collection efforts I've seen from academics who have tried to put a number on it, put the percentage of somewhere around 5% of the people in prison are there even though they are innocent. And, you know, that in one way that sounds like a small number. On the other hand, if you take into account that there are well over 100,000 inmates in the Texas prison system alone, then that's a whole lot of innocent people who are there.
Well, you know, considering that capital appeals can go on for decades, how is it actually possible that someone facing execution could be innocent with all this data and research?
Well, I think, you know, that's an often, I guess, cited trope about, you know, endless appeals and, you know, with, you know, so many eyes looking at it. How, you know, certainly there's no way a mistake could be made. But, in fact, the actual facts of the case and the actual factual decisions by the jury are pretty much accepted once you know, they have been made. They're really not reviewed. What is reviewed are various and sundry, you know, constitutional procedural issues. But what's generally, you know, not really looked at that closely is, if at all, through all these reviews, is, well, maybe the jury just got it wrong, you know, and to this day, the United States Supreme Court, a majority of the United States Supreme Court, does not recognize a claim of actual innocence, a claim of I did not do this, as a cognizable claim in the courts. In other words, the Supreme Court says, and it's the Herrera case, actually a death penalty from Texas from 1993, where Herrera was claiming, had a freestanding claim of actual innocence, and the Supreme Court said, that's not a claim we recognize. You know, if you want to talk about how bad your lawyer was, that's a claim we'll recognize. If you want to talk about the prosecution hiding evidence, that's a claim we'll recognize. But if you're just innocent and got convicted, even though you're innocent, that's not a claim we recognize, and that was in 1993, and that's true to and that's still true today. They have never recognized actual innocence as a claim for relief in any kind of case, including a death penalty case.
We are speaking right now with Mike Ware. He, of course, was one of the founders of the Innocence Project of Texas, formed in 2006. The time is right now 6:34. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Huntsville. And we are waiting to hear from our reporter, Ms. Joseph Clark, who is over at the Death House outside of Huntsville. We are waiting to see if the witnesses are coming back. Mike,
I'm Mike Gillespie. I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Correct me. Aren't the jurors the ultimate decisions of fact?
Yes.
So therefore, guilt and innocence is never decided by appellate court. They decide procedure.
That's correct.
So therefore, what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, what's wrong with it is sometimes the jurors obviously get it wrong.
Yeah, but if they're the ultimate declarer of the facts, the only thing you can attack is the evidence that was brought before them, so they made a wrong decision. But technically speaking, the appellate court can't reverse a finding of fact.
That's true 99.99% of the time, unless there is, in fact, what they say is legally insufficient evidence. Also, of course, in Texas actually does recognize actual innocence as a freestanding claim of relief. And so there is the possibility, and this is what we do, of after the case has been finalized, of finding new facts that were never presented to the jury. you know, such as experts, such as we, you know, DNA experts, such as photogrammetry, video analysis experts.
But that's procedural.
No, it's not. It's facts. It's coming back and saying if the jurors had
that's
these
right.
facts, they would have found this person
that's
innocent.
Correct. But procedurally, they didn't get all the facts to make a proper decision.
Well, so sometimes those facts are not available at the time.
I understand. Well,
why is it so hard for a person on death row to bring up claims of actual innocence the further along they get in the process?
Well, I don't know that it's really any harder for someone on death row to bring up a claim of actual innocence than any other convicted person. Making a claim, a successful claim of actual innocence, is very, very difficult for anybody. In Texas, the standard is clear and convincing. It has to be evidence, new evidence that was not introduced at trial and not available at the time of trial and could not have been reasonably discovered at the time of trial, new evidence, because of advances in technology or whatever, that had that new evidence been presented to the jurors at trial, those same jurors are a panel of reasonable jurors would not have convicted that person. And it has to be by a clear and convincing evidence standard.
But that's a procedural appeal.
They
didn't hear all the evidence.
Let's put a pin in this and get right back to it. But right now, I believe we have Mike Ware on, excuse me, Mike, we have Joseph Clark on the line from outside of the death row house in Huntsville. Joseph. Let's get back to our comrade. Joseph.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. The witnesses have just crossed back over the road, or, you know, the street.
So.
Hold up. Oh, it's over with.
Have you heard anything? Or we thank you for your time. We thank you for helping us out. And you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. You are listening to Execution Watch. We've just heard from Joseph Clark that the witnesses have come back. No. We're going to try and get Mike Ware back onto the line. He was unfortunately disconnected. Mike, if you're listening, come back. But let's ask a couple of more questions with our in-panel expert, Mike Lesby. It's an all Mike day, I suppose it was. But of course, Mark Solis has been put to death by the state of Texas. Now, Mike, let's get back just a little bit more about the co-defendant. Who was he? Why, again, would he have been sentenced so differently?
That's my question. That's
you think this
question.
Was a plea bargain situation?
I know it's a plea bargain situation. He turned state's evidence against his co-defendant in return for life without the death penalty. And that's what I'm saying. You should not pick one to live and one to die. It's not the DA's job to decide who's to live and who's to die. He got a deal. The other guy did not. Now, maybe he got the deal because he didn't act out in prison, that he didn't be violent in prison. I don't know.
Hmm.
But they decided that Solis was a dangerous one, and he was the one who needed to die. They didn't want any chance of him getting life with no parole, so they gave one life with no parole in return for him being executed. What I don't understand is what he could have said to cause this without corroborating evidence. Now, there might have been, I don't see, maybe the confession of Solis was the corroborating evidence, but you can't just go in and say, I did it with Bill. You know, it's a great way to date your friend's wife. Tell them that she did a crime with you. I mean, you can't do that.
Let's bring Mike Ware back into this conversation. Mike, are you back?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. What is the number one culprit in convicting and even executing people? What's the main?
You know, I think if I was to name the biggest problem, and this encompasses several other problems, it's tunnel vision on the part of the investigator and the prosecution after that. In other words, I think the psychological term that's close to that is confirmation bias. In other words, early on, they pick who their target is, and they decide that's who they're going to convict. And they you know, most of the time they do it, not all the time, but most of the time they do it because they really believe that that person is the guilty one. And then they conduct their investigation accordingly. Everything else from that point forward is to confirm that decision they've made that this person is guilty. They interview witnesses and prejudice and bias witnesses with that in mind. Junk science people are hired with that in mind to confirm this conviction. And probably worst of all, they will seek jailhouse, and I call them misinformants rather than informants, because, you know, there's nothing, most of the time, everything they say is not even true. And so after the person has been targeted for conviction, they, in a tunnel vision way, go about trying to make evidence to convict that person, whether it's recruiting jailhouse informants, recruiting junk scientists, or manipulating the way witnesses tell the story.
And how much of that is because the DAs can't afford to lose high-profile cases because they're not going to get advancement, not going to get promotions? At what point in time are they trying to do justice? At what point in time are they trying to justify their careers?
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think that certainly in a high-profile, high-stakes case, such as a murder case or particularly a capital murder case, they can't afford to lose it. I mean, there's all eyes on them, and that just increases the pressure on them to get a conviction and to push the envelope, so to speak, and certainly to be tempted to step not just on the line but over the line in order to get their conviction.
Can you recall any case in which a prosecutor used a death penalty case to promote his political career after the case was over with?
I think that's not uncommon, but you know, honestly, I can't think of a specific instance off the bat.
And that would be my answer too. Okay.
Yeah.
Now I've got another question for you, if I may.
Sure.
Do you do court appointments?
Not as many as I used to, but the court appointments I do now are mostly late in the are death penalty cases that are late in the process.
Do you agree that this case is a case of witnesses, not scientific evidence, not DNA evidence, not fingerprint evidence, this is a strict witness case? Do you agree with that?
You know, I honestly know just very little about the facts of this case, but from what I saw, that sounds right.
Now, I read the jury took 10 minutes to convict him. Can you explain court-appointed legal fees of $782,000 in this case?
You know, I saw that, and I don't know, I don't know that was all court-appointed lawyer fees. That was, I think that was, according to the newspaper, that was defense fees, and I assume that includes experts.
I'm sure it does, but again, I don't see any experts. I don't see any scientific evidence.
Well,
and there was no appeal for scientific evidence. That would be an appellate point.
And of course, we don't know what all went on behind the scenes, and simply because a defense attorney finds it necessary to have an expert appointed and to say, to do whatever scientific tests the experts do, and then makes a decision I guess in this case, perhaps not to put that expert on the stand because perhaps what they had to say was not helpful, doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of work and time involved.
Well, it seems like the prosecution spent $120,000 and the defense spent $780,000. Does that bother you?
You know, I like I said, I read that in the paper, and I would like to break that down. I mean, the first place, I assume that the fee or the amount that was attributed to the prosecution probably doesn't include all the fixed cost of the prosecutor. I mean, the prosecution, it takes a tremendous amount of money to run the prosecution office every year, a whole lot more than that. I think in Dallas, I forget what our budget was, $30 million a year, something like that. And so there's a whole lot of, I guess, I don't know what the accounting term is, but fixed cost that were not figured included in that figure.
If all of that totals $120,000, including the fixed cost of the building and the DA's office and the secretary and investigators, it really makes the $780,000 for a single defense lawyer in a little office to justify those fees.
Well, I really don't accept those premises simply because those were the figures that were put in the newspaper without really much explanation.
Well, let me ask you another question, and this is something I have read and I'm not too familiar with. I want to ask if you're familiar with.
I mean, my point is I don't doubt there was that much spent by the defense, but I think probably a whole lot more than that, if with any valid legal analysis, a whole lot more than what was put in there was spent by the prosecution.
Okay.
Those figures were something that were actually reported by the auditor of Johnson County. There was no breakdown, by the way.
Question to you. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania has changed the criminal laws, and I think it's a really big change. They allow defense lawyers to argue to the jury the cost of incarceration, the actual cost. What do you think about that?
You know, I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't see anything wrong with particularly if it's supported by evidence. But even if it's not, I don't see anything wrong with that because we've got a tremendous issue now, I think, in Texas with geriatric prisoners who are serving out life sentences that they received decades ago, and this is all at tremendous cost to taxpayers. That's a very different issue than what we deal with the Innocence Project of Texas. But since you asked the question, I don't see anything wrong with that.
But in terms of capital trials, do you think a jury should hear the difference in cost between a capital murder and life in prison? Do you think that should be put on the table, that what is costing society to execute somebody? That maybe the jury can say life in prison is cheaper for society?
From what I've seen, that's a fact. It does cost more to seek and get the death penalty into finally carry out an execution. It does cost more to do that than to house someone for the rest of their natural life. And I think, I don't see anything wrong with informing jurors about the truth on that.
Do you think it would affect the punishment jurors give to people when they realize the cost of society of locking somebody in jail?
Some jurors, yes. I think some jurors are very concerned about the costs of the criminal justice system and the various institutions within the criminal justice system and what it does to them as taxpayers. I think some jurors are very concerned about that. Not all of them, but some are.
Mike, let me ask you, what do you consider a good day?
A good day?
Yeah.
A good day is when I get an opinion back from the Court of Criminal Appeals agreeing with us that our client is actually innocent. That's a good day.
And how often does that happen?
Not often enough, but it happens enough that it keeps me going.
Do you think that there's any shift in what the general public believe about capital punishment?
You know, I think that that there are less, and I believe, you know, the data backs me up. In let's talk about Texas, where capital punishment is actually carried out, and people are tried for the death penalty. I think that there are less death sentences returned now than when I first started practicing. I don't know what all the reasons for that are. Some of it may be that, some jurors may be troubled by the DNA exonerations or other exonerations where someone who, not even necessarily a death penalty case, but a very serious case and maybe a death penalty case where, and I can think of some specific instances of death penalty cases. Anthony Graves,
of course,
for example, who was on death row for a long time and turned out to be actually innocent. And I think perhaps some jurors are concerned from that aspect. But also, Texas now has life without the possibility of parole. And I think jurors see that, some jurors see that, as a very reasonable alternative to execution as opposed to what the law has been in the past. I think the law, at some point during my career, has been as little as 15 years someone would be eligible for parole if they got a life sentence on a capital murder case. Now, none of them made it in 15 years, but the prosecutors always tried to lead the jury to believe that that would be the result if they returned a life sentence, that this guy would be out in 15 years. It was not true, but I think jurors were concerned about that, and I suspect that one of the reasons there are less death penalty verdicts returned now, one of the reasons is because there is the option of life without the possibility of parole.
And why do you personally do this?
Well, there's my practice is very little. I do have a couple of death penalty cases, and in the ones I have, in the particular ones I have, I believe that the death penalty was gotten in a very unfair and inaccurate way, that there are real problems with the process, with how this person got on death row. Now, the innocence cases are different, you know. I mean, those are different issues. And it's hard to imagine a greater injustice, you know, at whatever level, than being accused of and convicted of something that you had nothing to do with. We've all known that since we were children, and for it to be, you know, happen to an adult and to be locked up in prison for something they did not do. It's very satisfying to get justice for those individuals and their families.
And you certainly have been doing your fair share of doing that, and we appreciate what you do for people. Thank you.
Well, you're very kind to say that. Thank you.
Again, thank you, Mr. Ware. We've been speaking with Mike Ware, one of the founders of the Innocence Project of Texas. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. I'm here with Mike Gillespie. We've been discussing the case and the execution of Mark Anthony Solis, who has just been put to death by the state of Texas. If you're interested in learning about the death penalty here in the state of Texas, there are lots of different ways, lots of different organizations, ways to get involved, ways to find out what's happening in the state in your particular name. We are coming to the end of this program. It is time to wrap it up. And I want you to know that if you are listening overseas, if you are one of our international listeners, there are so many ways that you can still be involved here at KPFT. This is the radio for peace. This is the radio station that can help you connect with so many different issues, whether it's the prison show, whether it's Coming to America, which is about to come on, whether it's Nuestras Palabras, which will tell you about the fabulous growing world of Latino literature right here in the state of Texas. Whatever it is, we have a program for you, and you can find all of that information on kpft.org. Please join us again next Wednesday, on Wednesday, September the 25th at 6 p.m., when the state of Texas plans to execute Robert Sparks. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, joining our mailing list for all the latest updates. And please, please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others with a secure contribution to this station. Again, my thanks to Mike Gillespie, to our special guest, to Mike Ware, to our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, to our Death House reporter, Joseph Clark, and our engineer, Rick Campbell, for their assistance on today's show. Coming up next.
I want to say one more thing. I have a client who works for the penal system, and she's the one who fills out the death certificate for these men. And what I want to correct you is they weren't executed, they were murdered. Because that's what the death certificate says, issued by the state, murdered by the state, not executed, murdered. She asked me, why do they say murdered? I have no answer for it.
Well, that's that. You've been listening to Mike Gillespie and Marlo Blue. Coming up next, Coming to America. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.